For 7 years, Rick Emerson dug into the story behind the massively popular book called Go Ask Alice. It was published in 1971, and reading it became a rite of passage for millions of American teenagers. Emerson says the Alice in the story was weighed down by adolescence. She was self-conscious about her weight, her social standing. In desperation, she turned to her diary, where she could share her anguish and her doubt. And because the Alice in the story was swept away by a culture of permissive sex and drug use, her death by overdose at age 17 served as this cautionary tale. And that resonated with people, even though it turned out it's not a real story. For the most part, Go Ask Alice was the creation of a woman living in Utah County who happened to have really good timing. Emerson told us it begins in 1969 with a real tragic story of a real young woman. In fact, the daughter of the TV and radio personality Art Linkletter.
On October 4th, his daughter Diane Linkletter jumped out of her sixth-floor apartment building in West Hollywood. She died, and the news cycle at that point was already really overstuffed because Chappaquiddick had happened, and we'd been to the moon, and the killing of Sharon Tate and all the other people at the Tate House, that had already happened. And yet, Diane Linkletter's suicide was everywhere. I think in the first 10 days after she died, Art Linkletter received something like 25,000 handwritten letters of condolence. I think for a lot of parents of children who commit suicide, there is this reflexive desire to blame oneself and to think like, I did this. I must have missed something. And you're just left with this why, and that why can be corrosive. It can eat you alive. And so Diane Linkletter kills herself, and at some point, her brother, Robert Linkletter, tells Art Linkletter that Diane had taken some LSD. And that instantly hardens into gospel, certainly for the Linkletter family. And then it filters out into the press, and then it's everywhere. Eventually, that story gets adjusted a little bit because the toxicology screen comes back, and it's not that she tested negative for LSD. It's just at the time, they didn't test her for LSD at all. That technology was just not available. It was considered an impossible task to test somebody postmortem for LSD. So then the story shifted a little bit, and the story became that she had died while in the midst of an LSD flashback. And nobody could really disprove it. So that then became the final form the story took. The LSD story, A, gives you an answer and answers the question of why. And it also exonerates Diane to some degree. So when Art Linkletter goes and gives this press conference, he's out of his mind with fatigue and grief and rage at the idea that someone, you know, gave LSD to his daughter. So when he first speaks to the press, he says it wasn't her fault because she wasn't herself when she died. And so it's a way to say that she may have done this horrible thing, which some people view as a mortal sin, but it was not her fault. It was the fault of LSD. And so that, in turn, also becomes part of the public narrative where, I forget the actual figure, but something like 2,000 newspaper stories within the next 60 days effectively pinning Diane Linkletter's suicide on LSD. And the other thing that happens literally overnight is that Art Linkletter becomes just this fire-breathing anti-drug zealot. You know, he really entered this kind of burn-it-all-down phase of his life where his solution to the drug problem just became round them up and throw them in a hole, you know, round them up and throw the switch, let them rot. And so that became the only thing that Art Linkletter was interested in.
Do you want to join me here? Won't you be seated, please, ladies and gentlemen?
At the same time, the Nixon administration had been trying to ramp up a war on drugs.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
And to do that, he needed congressional approval. And of course, a lot of things that need congressional approval in turn need public approval.
A new all-out offensive.
And Nixon and Linkletter had been friends. And When Diane Linkletter died, Nixon's administration, his aides, saw this opportunity. They thought, you know, you should send this letter to Art Linkletter, you know, this letter of condolence, and with luck, Art Linkletter will read it, and it'll really, you know, A, burnish your image as a good guy, and B, give you some ammunition to help launch this war on drugs.
This will be a worldwide offensive dealing with...
Linkletter ended up going to the White House, and this is only 2 weeks after she's killed herself. And Nixon effectively uses Art Linkletter as a prop. You know, Nixon tells Linkletter in so many words, like, anything you can do to help fight this scourge, you know, don't you want to help your country? Don't you want to help, you know, destroy this social ill that took your daughter? And Linkletter, of course, for, you know, reasons that are, you know, tragic and eminently human and understandable, you know, he is just in absolute vengeance mode. And he's, you know, yes, anything I can do. So Linkletter leaves the White House just really determined to do anything he can to help destroy this, you know, this monster, this chemical monster that took his daughter. And it's right then that he hears from a woman named Beatrice Sparks. And she emerges with the most amazing story. And she says, I've got this diary of a young girl who was a good, decent, you know, Christian, all-American girl. The diary of this girl who gets pulled into drug use and who dies at 17. She left behind a diary. I've got it. And it coincidentally confirms everything you already believe about LSD and about drugs. It's the perfect pitch at the perfect time.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Rick Emerson is joining us to talk about his new book. It's called Unmask Alice. He told us he was looking for an idea when this one came to him, literally like a flash of blue light.
I'd been having breakfast with my friend Peter Ames Carlin, and he's an author, and you know, we were talking about, he said, what are you working on? And I kind of bluffed this answer because I wasn't really working on anything. And on the way home, I was just thinking about nothing in particular, but some part of my brain had obviously been thinking about this for quite a while. And my brain sometimes works like a sort of like a toaster, you know, where you put the Pop-Tart in and you push the button and then later it just emerges. So this idea had been building for a while. And on the way home back to my house, I thought, I wonder if there's a book about Go Ask Alice and the real story behind it. And I assumed that there had been. I thought somebody must have already told the story. And I spent some time looking on the internet, as one does now with everything. And the more I looked, kind of the more astonished I was that this book did not already exist. Yeah. And so, I mean, this sounds a little too pat, but I sort of felt like the only way I was going to be able to read this book was if I wrote
it. It seems like this is a very Utah story, which may surprise people outside of this place. And so I wonder about that. Do you see it in many ways as – which you sort of do lay out in the book, the Utah connections, obviously. And I wonder if it helped that you lived here for a time. Did you put those two together?
To some degree. I mean, I lived in Utah for a couple of years. Now, a lot of places have their own culture. Utah definitely does. There is definitely a Utah vibe and a Utah culture, and Utah has its own unique history. And so to some degree that informed it, although I think, you know, in a larger sense, but it was certainly nothing I knew going into this. In other words, it wasn't like I thought, aha, my long ago Utah knowledge will suddenly pay off. I didn't realize beginning this story how deeply interwoven it was. In other words, I didn't realize how numerous and deep the Utah connections were. I mean, if you had told me at the beginning that this story literally goes from Hollywood to the FBI labs at Quantico, you know, the behavioral science labs, to literally into the Oval Office, to all kinds of places beyond that, but that at many points it all intersects in Utah County, you know, this little strip of Utah desert that has been famously called the fraud capital of America.
So I just want to give listeners a heads up that we're not going to give everything away. I mean, there's a clue in the subtitle of the book, the word imposter, that lets us know Go Ask Alice isn't exactly real. But there's the question of, was there an actual Alice? And that part we're going to leave to readers to find in the book, because there are plenty of other things to talk about that reveal plenty about this, really, not just the story itself, but the phenomenon and the context, as we've already been talking about. We should, I think, also say, Rick, that here at the top here, that Go Ask Alice is still a thing. Like, you can buy it right now. It hasn't been debunked and disgraced. You can still buy it.
Go Ask Alice is, I mean, it's a fascinating book. I will say at the outset that if you've never read it, or if you read it a long time ago, it might, in your memory or in your conception of it, people sometimes remember it as being kitschy or being campy or corny. And I sometimes compare Go Ask – I've compared it to a lot of things. But one of the things I sometimes compare Go Ask Alice to is the movie Saturday Night Fever, which is, for people who have never seen Saturday Night Fever or who saw it a long time ago, they think of John Travolta and the white suit and disco, and they remember it being this campy, funny, tongue-in-cheek film, when in reality it is not. Saturday Night Fever is – I mean, it's a great movie, but it's a dark, dark, bleak film. And it's very much a Scorsese film in its vibe and its tone. And Go Ask Alice is kind of the same way. There are there are things that are dated because it has a lot of 70s and hippie, you know, sort of hippie jargon and flower power talk. But at the same time, there are sections of Go Ask Alice that are just, even today, ring absolutely horrifying and shocking. And one of the reasons Go Ask Alice endures is because it does capture that feeling adolescence, that sort of live wire mix of, you know, I'm a child, but I'm an adult, and I feel exuberant, but I feel depressed, I have all of these responsibilities, but I still can't vote, and, you know, adults expect things from me, but they won't give me freedom, and I'm happy all the time, and I'm sad all the time. And the, you know, when you're a teenager, from my memory anyway, you know, you simultaneously feel like you are going crazy and that you are the only sane person on the planet. And Go Ask Alice really nails that insane, hyperkinetic rush of emotions. And I think that's one of the reasons why every year there's a new, you know, wave of teenagers that discovers that book and it speaks to them.
Well, they find meaning and some kind of authenticity and comfort in it. And it's such an interesting book. You mentioned this in your book that, you know, there are no chapters. It's just this kind of chain of entries. There aren't really dates. You know, names are referenced in some cases without any other kind of context. I mean, you say the result of going through it is a kind of – you describe it as a dazed momentum. But it must seem if you're young and you're looking for someone to trust or someone to relate – it must seem real reading that book, you know?
Yeah, it certainly feels real. And I think to some degree that's the crucial distinction. Something I learned and something I discovered again and again when I was doing this research is that with Go Ask Alice, there's this dichotomy that emerges where adults focus on what Alice does, the fact that she takes drugs and she has sex and she runs away from home and she falls in with these scurrilous friends and she makes all of these, you know, these terrible choices. Adults focus on what she does. Young readers tend to focus on who she is. So adults say, I can't believe what this girl is doing. The world is going to hell. Whereas young people say, this girl breaks my heart and I identify with what she's feeling, whether or not it's true. I mean, it's the same reason why, you know, we see ourselves in all kinds of works of fiction, whether they're filmed, whether they're written, whether it's a song. I mean, you listen to Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles. I mean, I am neither a British priest nor a woman keeping her face in a jar by the door. And yet, when you listen to Eleanor Rigby, you know, you get a feeling from those, you know, and there may be moments in your life when passages from that song speak to you. And it doesn't mean that it's because you lived that experience. It means that whatever is being felt by the characters in that song, you are feeling at that moment. And another comparison that I sometimes make is to the Stephen King novel, Carrie, because Carrie continues to be a huge bestseller and a big book with teenagers. And I think it's not because teenagers have pyrotelekinetic powers. It's because Carrie White feels like an outcast and a loner. And she has this fractious relationship with her mom. And she feels like an ugly duckling and like she's never wearing the right things and she's not popular. The other stuff is just window dressing. I think it's the same with Alice. It's a truth beyond truth.
Yeah. You say that in the book, that the early readers of the book would encounter it, and then they would look for these clues on the inside flap of it. Like, is this real? Is this fiction? Does it describe itself as a novel? And you say that's part of its mystique, or was anyway, you know, and it got people talking and buying the book. But the book, of course, didn't say – it didn't mention Beatrice Sparks. And we'll get to that story here in a moment, but I guess that's the really intriguing part of it. It was just anonymous, and that gave it this kind of mystery, I guess.
Well, and that's a technique that, you know, is probably timeless. I mean, even if we know that someone at the publishing company has done that simply and solely as an attention-getting tactic, it still works, especially with Go Ask Alice, because you're never supposed to read somebody's diary. I mean, that's – everybody knows that. That's, you don't even have to be told. We just know culturally that to read somebody else's diary is unacceptable. That is because it's a sacrosanct thing. And so, A, it's a diary that's being given to you and you're being told not only can you read this, but you should read this. It's good for you to read this. And also there's this often unspoken but very real – sort of compellingly grim aspect of, oh, and the girl is dead, which, you know, just lends this sort of dark mystique to it. And again, the fact that we don't know who she is the way it's presented, because a lot of paperback versions of the book, and some of them still say this on the inside, they say, Alice could be anyone. Alice could be someone you know.
Tell us who Beatrice Sparks is. I mean, we'll dig into the details as we go. Her story, the first part of her story, we'll jump back into the part where in the mid-1960s she starts to create this kind of persona. But tell us who she is before then.
So Beatrice Sparks, she grew up in Cache County in Logan, and which, you know, is not a gigantic place now, but was a much, much smaller place then. Yeah. And then when she was in her late teens, you know, her family sort of splintered. You know, there was some domestic strife that happened, and she ended up moving to California and really was out on her own for a while. And if this is right as the Great Depression is just at its apex or nadir, however you want to look at that. And so it was a terrible time in America in general, much less to be a young woman on her own, out trying to survive and scraping to get by. And to go from Logan, Utah to anywhere is a bit of a culture shock. But to go from Logan, Utah to San Francisco is just a galactic shift. So she's out on her own, you know, eventually gets married and starts a family. And through this whole time, she's attempting to, you know, to break through as a writer. And, you know, she has a lot of dreams and a lot of aspirations. And she's very interested in psychology and psychiatry and the way that, you know, humans behave. And a lot of these things dovetail, you know, they mix together in a lot of her work and a lot of her writing. And, you know, she really was, and I mean this in the best way, she really was, you know, a hustler in the sense that she, you know, looked for opportunities and, you know, and tried to find every opening into the industry that she could. But she really kept pushing and kept trying to make it, you know, and she was a great networker and she was really skilled selling herself. And that's one of the things that paid off for her.
Yeah. You describe this time when she, as you say, she and her husband, LaVorne, by the way, is his name, which there's a Utah name, if you ever heard one. And they sort of went different places, but they end up, you know, he does well. They are a successful family. And by the time they get in, you know, establish themselves in Utah County, as you say, you describe this moment when they have this, you know, kind of a 60s version of a McMansion, it sounds like, you know, this six white pillars on the front of it. And she plays this, she role played the person she wished to be, is how you describe it in the book. She wanted to be cultured and educated. And it's like she's kind of like she's creating this persona. At least that's what the way I saw it. And then you mention how she comes to this point in her life. She's middle-aged or a little older than that. She's 53. Kids are mostly grown up. She had, you know, published a few things. But mostly what she had to show for her life was just a string of these fizzled projects, as you say. What does she want in her life? What is she looking for? Is she looking for fame? Is she looking for notoriety? Because this seems like the critical moment when, as we talked about earlier, this idea that she has or this moment converges.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned earlier this being a very Utah story. And in some ways, Utah culture, it's a distilled version of American culture. And when I say American culture, I mean America as it was presented not just to the rest of the world for most of the 20th century, but as it was presented back to Americans in the 20th century, this idea of American exceptionalism and the American dream and, you know, the idea that, you know, it's tempting to – I'm always tempted to use Ronald Reagan as sort of the – one of the other embodiments of this. But this idea that, you know, no matter who you are, no matter where you're born, no matter what you come from, if you just work hard enough and if you – this is, you know, if you put your nose to the grindstone and all of that, that you can become – and we all – you know, and we know that there's a lot of dog whistling going on there. And we know that obviously a lot of that just isn't true. We know that a lot of that is not true, at least not true for big sections of society. And – but at the same time – that's a tremendously appealing idea. And for people of that generation, especially coming out of World War II, there was this sense that the ultimate mark of your redemption, personal and otherwise, is success. Success and the fame that comes with that. And those two things were, I mean, they were clearly very, very important to her.
Rick Emerson, he's a former radio host. His book is called Unmask Alice, LSD, Satanic Panic, and the Imposter Behind the World's Most Notorious Diaries. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Rick Emerson is joining us, telling us the story behind the 1971 phenomenon, Go Ask Alice. The book was marketed as this unexpurgated diary entry of a 17-year-old girl who fell in with the wrong crowd, became addicted to drugs, and died tragically alone and misunderstood. But it's not a real story. The story was a concoction conceived in Utah County by a Latter-day Saint woman who exploited the social panic over drugs and Satanism, and she never came clean. The book is called Unmask Alice. So we were talking earlier about this moment. Art Linkletter's daughter jumps to her death. It's believed it was because she had taken LSD. It becomes this national movement. It becomes Art Linkletter's, you know, cause, and it just so happens Beatrice has this story that fits perfectly with the moment. She makes her pitch to Linkletter, and that, you know, she has this diary. A girl left a diary. She finds it. And Linkletter bites. He's like on board with, you know, trying to get this thing published. And so, what do we know about the story that starts to develop? You say, you know, parts changed with the telling, but the basics were the same. How do we know – what's the story Beatrice is telling about how she meets this girl that would come to be known as Alice?
As you said, the narrative, the backstory kind of shifted, with depending on the day or just the way the wind was blowing. It was she right. did on some level seem incapable of telling the same story twice. But the outer details shifted, but the core explanation was always the same. It was the story as it came to be told was that Sparks had met this girl that we all now call Alice. That she had met Alice at a youth camp. In 1970, you know, she'd become friends with a girl. They had this connection. They bonded, and that they then stayed in contact. They stayed in communication later, and that at some point, not too long after that, Alice had died. Beatrice came into possession of Alice's diary or diaries. Sometimes there was one diary. Sometimes there was two. Sometimes there were more. And then either on her own or in consultation with Alice's parents, decided that, well, this could help other teens or other families, and then worked to edit it and to get it published. That was the core of the story she told.
Yeah. And there are all these questions with this, you know, diary idea that, you know, like, who could her identity be verified? Who were Alice's parents? Was, as you say in the book, was this even legal? But you say, right, Linkletter's reaction was all that mattered was that he was on board. That's all that mattered to her. Like, that he, Linkletter said, this is good, and which did make me wonder how complicit was Art Linkletter in the hoax in some ways.
When I say that Art Linkletter was his opinion that was all that mattered, I mean, that's certainly true. You know, obviously his opinion mattered greatly to Beatrice Parks because he was a power broker and had been for quite some time. He was also, you know, one of the faces of the early, you know, of the nascent anti-drug movement. But more importantly, his opinion was all that mattered professionally and within the industry, right, because not only was Linkletter, he had the president's home number, and Walt Disney was his daughter's godfather. So he's a man who knows a lot of people. He's also vastly wealthy and important and powerful himself. Mm-hmm. Not only that, Art Linkletter was a best-selling author. So Art Linkletter had already sold, I think, 8 million copies of a book that a lot of people will remember called Kids Say the Darndest Things. And Art Linkletter also co-owned and co-operated his own literary agency. So he had a lot of connections inside the world of entertainment and media. So, you know, the fact that Art Linkletter said, hey, this is good, we ought to do something with this, for most people, that was enough to just say, like, yeah, you know, obstacles be damned, we're going to make this happen.
The Mormon part is interesting. There's not a lot of reference, if much at all, to Mormon culture, the fact that this was maybe a Mormon, you know, a youth camp or youth conference. How much did Beatrice reveal about the LDS part? I wonder if she was sensitive to the idea that maybe Latter-day Saints were seen with some suspicion in the 70s, or she didn't want to alienate a segment of the audience. You know, how much of this was a Mormon tale? Did she imagine, you know, what was the audience? Certainly not just Mormons. I mean, how did that fit into all of this?
Certainly with Go Ask Alice, there was – it did end up becoming, you know, a huge part of the culture. And I think to some degree that's because the way the diary is written and or presented and or edited, depending on one's level of skepticism, it's presented in a very neutral way. Alice was presented in this, what would have been throughout the 20th century and probably still now, referred to as an all-American girl, which of course meant white and suburban and middle class and Christian and all of these things. And, so she was very much presented in as a sort of as a kind of cultural template. Now, to your question about Beatrice Parks and how she discussed this, as with many, if not most, things in this story, her telling of the backstory shifted a little bit depending on the audience. And so if she was talking to somebody, you know, who was from, you know, Los Angeles, or who was from Florida, you know, it was sometimes a little bit more of a flat, featureless backstory. If she was talking to somebody who was in Southern Idaho, then she would occasionally drop in references to Latter-day Saints or to Utah culture specifically. Whatever anybody wants to say about Beatrice Parks, she was good at reading a room, and she knew at any given moment, you know, what her audience wanted and or needed to hear, and was very compelling and charismatic, you know, when she told those stories.
There's a really interesting moment you tell about, and it turns out it's a kind of a critical point when Beatrice is selling the book to Prentice Hall, the publisher, Catherine Fitzgerald. She's in charge of the project there at the publishing house. They don't want Beatrice Sparks' name in the title. They like the idea of it being anonymous, and Beatrice freaks out. She doesn't like this idea, but it turns out it works better for her in the long run. But say a little bit about that, because it did reveal to me that Beatrice does want the fame that might be associated if this book becomes something.
Yeah, and the process by which that happened, you know, that's something I go into in the book, and that is its own kind of fascinating reveal. I will say, to your point, that is one of the things that is a maybe not an ancillary benefit, maybe the primary benefit, and I think maybe an unexpected dividend from anonymizing the book. Because, again, even if you come at it from the perspective that this is a flat-out, absolutely authentic, genuine diary that was edited by adult hands, you know, for an audience, even if you assume that, it still connects on a greater level because there is no adult presence. In other words, even if everything we've been told about the diary was absolutely true, the fact that it still feels like a connection between you and this young diarist, that really is to the book's benefit. At the same time, it's hard to imagine anybody being associated with something that is so momentous and so impactful. I mean, that book comes out in September 71. It sells eventually something like 5 million copies, probably more. You know, it's translated into 16 languages. It's, you know, an Emmy-nominated made-for-TV movie. It effectively creates the modern young adult genre. It helps to solidify a lot of thoughts, especially among older people, about the war on drugs. So it's, and it's still half a century later, a huge part of the culture. It's hard to imagine anybody being blasé about just having their participation redacted or obscured. I think that would require superhuman selflessness to not feel like you just, you know, been sort of deleted from that part of history.
Yeah. One of the things you mention in the book is how later when and we don't need to give too much away, but when she actually gets interrogated about certain parts of her story, she doesn't stand up to it very well. And you say that if that kind of scrutiny had happened early on in Go Ask Alice, if her name had appeared on it, it might not have turned out in the same way.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, obviously it's hard to say for sure, although, you know, one of the things about Go Ask Alice is that somebody asked me one time if I thought it was well written. And it's almost impossible to answer that question because if you read it thinking, well, this is the diary of a 15, 16, 17-year-old girl who for large sections of the diary is out of her mind on drugs, then it absolutely rings authentic. And one of the things I think that worked in Alice's favor is that the anonymity of it and the idea that it was the work of a young girl, of a, you know, this teenage girl, that in many ways was a shield, because early reviewers and mainstream reviewers certainly didn't want to be seen to be stomping on the writing of this poor dead teenage girl. And so there was this idea of, we need to be respectful to this girl who A, is already dead, B, had this horrible tragedy, C, inadvertently left this document that might be beneficial to, you know, to future generations and to kids and families now. And so there was this reluctance to press too hard. It's 2022, and right now, you know, there's something like 25% of this country doesn't believe we went to the moon. So I don't think you have to look too hard in this country to find people who are exceptionally skilled and becoming more so by the day at avoiding reality and fact.
Rick Emerson, his book is called Unmask Alice. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Rick Emerson. We're talking about his book, which tells the backstory, the real story, to the 1971 teenage diary, Go Ask Alice. It's called Unmask Alice. So there's another story you tell in the book. In fact, it's an important part of Unmask Alice. And we don't need to get into too much, to reveal too much. I think it's something that readers can find for themselves. But it's a really amazing story. It's an important part of the book. It's a story of a real teenager. And in some ways, it parallels the story of Alice. This one plays out in Pleasant Grove, Utah. It's sad and heartbreaking, and you spend a lot of time with it in the book. I'm not sure how much you want to say about it, but you talk a little bit about this moment, because it's a really critical way of you telling this larger story.
Yeah, and, you know, for people who Certainly people who grew up in Utah, and I think especially for people who grew up in Utah County, I mean, they will know this story, or they will have heard about it, or they will have lived through parts of this. So there's a book called Jay's Journal, and that came out in 1979. And in many ways, Jay's Journal is sort of a sibling book to Go Ask Alice. It's, again, this supposed posthumous diary of a teenager, this time a young boy. And it's the story of this teenage boy who gets lured into witchcraft, into the occult, and eventually ends up committing suicide at 16 and leaves this diary behind, which is, you know, edited and released as this book called Jay's Journal. And it, in turn, just as Go Ask Alice, you know, was fueled by and accelerated the drug war, Jay's Journal, you know, helped to launch and certainly helped to accelerate what we now call the Satanic Panic, which is this 15-year literal witch hunt that tore through America in the 80s and 90s and destroyed lives left and right. And Jay's Journal, there is a real life person. There is a real person, a real teenager at the core of that book. And
we should mention Beatrice Sparks is the one who produces that book.
Yes. Don't
leave that part out, because basically, and again, I don't know how much you want to say, but Beatrice Sparks takes this real sad story. I don't know. I'll put it how I found it, kind of distorts it, tries to make it fit into this obsession that is, you know, taking over popular culture about Satanism and witchcraft.
Yeah, and I'm glad you reminded me of that, because again, I glossed over the most important part, which is that Jay's Journal is, when I said it's a sibling book to Go Ask Alice, where Go Ask Alice was, you know, the official story is that it was a diary edited by Beatrice Sparks, but of course she was left off the cover. Jay's Journal actually just says in large block letters, it just says edited by Beatrice Sparks, the woman who discovered Go Ask Alice. And the backstory is, you know, again, as I said, very similar. It's where Beatrice Sparks has this real teenage diary. She edited it into this book called Jay's Journal. And while there are several dozen entries in Jay's Journal that are drawn often word for word, sometimes completely unchanged from a real diary, you know, there's a lot in that book that is not from a real diary. So there's, you know, there's this core of truth surrounded by this larger creation. And it really just had unbelievable and horrific fallout, not just for the family involved and not just for Utah County, but for the entire United States. I mean, anybody who lived through the 80s and 90s or has read anything about that era, I mean, I'm a big fan of that show, Stranger Things, on Netflix. And, you know, Stranger Things, their entire fourth season, which just wrapped, it was, you know, sort of shot through with the Satanic Panic. That was one of the major storylines of this series. And it's one of those things that if it had not really happened and if it had not had such horrific consequences for so many people involved, the Satanic Panic would seem, A, absurd. I mean, it is sort of absurd, but it's also horrifying. And it would seem unbelievable, because it's, it is even now difficult to believe and grasp that, you know, for the better part of two decades, there were adults. I mean, there were grown men and women, many of them in positions of considerable authority, many of them police or prosecutors or judges or people who sat on juries, who arrested people, put people on trial, in many cases convicted people, in some cases sentenced people to death for being part of satanic ritual, you know, murders, or, you know, for occult crimes, things that not only hadn't happened, but things that physically, scientifically could not have happened. Now, Jay's Journal was a part of accelerating that entire panic. And the core of that book, as I said, does come from a real life teenager who lived in Pleasant Grove, Utah. And it is an unbelievable, you know, fascinating, compelling, horrifying, heartbreaking story.
One of the things you explore in the book is just how much books are not regulated in the same way food or medicine is in this country, and that there really isn't a system to properly fact-check books, you call it the honor system, basically. So what is the understanding about that, and about how does that play into the way people find the book and decide whether to whether this is real today. As you say, it's still being sold. It's still being marketed. So how does that all work? The idea of trying to assess whether this thing is true.
Well, you know, to some degree, as you said, it is, it is an honor system. And I think I mentioned in the book that, the problem with honor systems is that honor systems are only effective for people who don't really need an honor system. If you are inclined to do the right thing, you don't need an honor system to tell you that. And, in America, if you go buy, a sleeping bag or a can of soup, for the most part, it's got to tell you what's inside. Now, there are bad actors and there are sometimes companies who act outside the law, sure. But if you go buy, a box of cereal, for the most part, on the side, it's got to tell you, some weasel words notwithstanding, what's in that food. And books are just this towering exception to a degree that I didn't even really understand before diving into this, that in the United States, at least, words like fiction, and I mean, this sounds ridiculous, but it's true that words like fiction or nonfiction or memoir don't really have any fixed meaning. They don't have any legal weight. And there's nothing is really incumbent upon the author, the agent, the editor, the publisher to label those things accurately. Now, obviously, when you're dealing with something like memoir, there's always going to be things that are subjective. And even if you are someone who is attempting to write an absolutely 100% fact-based book, errors on some level, are going to crop up, and you try to find them and spot them and get them out, to whatever degree you can. Anything that is a historical event is always going to be, to some degree, subject to that kind of honest, research-based mistake or an incomplete understanding of something. That is a world apart from fabricating something and then marketing it as nonfiction or the reverse. There are, in fact, nonfiction books that have been marketed as fiction. And when I say marketed, it's done simply for commercial reasons. And people have, I think, an idea, and I certainly did going into this, that in the world of publishing, that every publishing house is armed with an army of fact checkers that go over every last word in a book, and try to separate, truth from fact and mistake, from fiction. And it just ain't so. And that's largely a result of two things. One is budgeting. The margins on books, the profit margin on books has always been fairly thin. It's even thinner now. And there's just, to some degree, is not money in the budget for fact checkers, although there are certain large publishing conglomerates that I will not name whose profits are in the hundreds of millions, who could undoubtedly foot the bill for a few fact checkers if they deemed it important. But that leads us to the second part, which is that there really is no penalty for publishers, at least, if they misrepresent a book. There's sometimes a penalty for the author, although not even that seems to have much effect in some ways. But there's almost no penalty for the publisher because they're usually indemnified by contract. And plus, the general book buying public, for the most part, understandably, doesn't really care who published a book. If you go buy a new, if you go buy the new John Grisham book, or you're going to buy the new Stephen King, or any, you're going to go buy some book to read at the beach or at an airport or whatever, it doesn't really matter to you who the publisher is. What you want is a good book, and you might care who the author is, but you're not really going to give a lot of thought to, like, I don't know, who edited this book? That doesn't really matter all that much. And so as a result, there's not much penalty for, as is usually the case in American systems, if penalties are meted out, they are usually the stiffer and stronger and more concrete the penalty, the lower down the food chain you're going to be. The higher up the food chain you get, the less and more toothless that penalty is going to be. See also financial crime. And so, I'm not saying publishers should go to prison, but I am saying that the farther up that publishing chain you get, the less accountability there seems to be and the fewer consequences there seem to be for willfully, and that's, I'm underscoring that, for willfully misrepresenting something that you know is not accurate.
Beatrice Sparks died 10 years ago. Who's making money off Go Ask Alice today?
Well, certainly the publisher. Simon & Schuster put out a 50th anniversary edition last year. That book continues to sell. And that's 50 years after that book's release. It really is quite something. The larger imprint of that book is really cultural in that If you read Go Ask Alice, then it directly impacted your life. But the thing is, even if you did not read Go Ask Alice, in fact, even if you have never heard of Go Ask Alice, it has still impacted your life. And the same is true for Jay's Journal in some way. I mean, you know, if you look at pop culture today, and if you look at Stranger Things, or, you know, people will talk about the fear over Dungeons and Dragons, all of those mm-hmm. things in some ways can be traced back to Go Ask Alice and Jay's Journal, with these sort of twin poles of mm-hmm. American dread. You know, and you know, and there's just no denying the fact that, I mean, look, I mean, Go Ask Alice is, I mean, that book's going to outlive us all. I mean, that book will be around when I am long gone. There's no, I mean, that's just, I mean, for good or bad, it is just unavoidable. It is an interwoven part of the American fabric and shall forever remain so.
You describe it as a social Rorschach test.
Absolutely, because, I think that is another reason why Go Ask Alice persist, because what you just mentioned there, the social Rorschach aspect, meaning that if you are a teenager in 1971, so toward the end of the book, and this is not a spoiler, but toward the end of the book, I profile a handful of people and I sort of walk through their first experience reading Go Ask Alice. And one of them is in 1971. And another's in the late 70s or the mid 70s. And, you know, and then there's one is in the 90s. And then I think the last person I profile is a young woman named Morgan, who she discovered Go Ask Alice in 2010 when she was 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And Go Ask Alice made a massive impact on her. I mean, is one of the reasons she is today and has always been clean and sober. And so, if you are a young person in any one of those eras, Go Ask Alice, you know, to some degree was a thing that could speak to you. At the same time, if you were a parent looking for evidence of America going down the tubes, or if you were looking for proof that today's kids were out of control or were endangered or needed a drug crackdown, guess what? You could find evidence for that in Go Ask Alice. If you believe that the publishing industry is corrupt and immoral and, you know, and will do anything, you know, including subvert truth to make a buck, you can find evidence for that in Go Ask Alice. If you believe that books, whether they are fiction or nonfiction or somewhere in between, have the power to change your life and impact your life and to resonate with you and to make you feel less alone and to make you feel as though someone somewhere understands you, you're going to find that in Go Ask Alice. Mm-hmm. If you're a cynic, if you're a believer, if you're anywhere in between, there's something in that book for you.
Finally, here's how you put it in the book, and it kind of brings us back to the young person reaction, people who found something in it that seemed profound and meaningful, that there was hope or someone to relate to or trust. Here's how you put it in the book. Fiction or not, she was real, and she understood.
Absolutely. You know, I guess there's no better way to really, for me at least, because I don't want to try to get into the mind of a teenager today, but I will say that when I discovered Go Ask Alice when I think I was 14, and I saw it sitting on the just returned shelf at the high school library. And I, you know, like a million people before and after me, I saw the sort of half shadowed face on the cover, and I saw those eight words, you know, Go Ask Alice, a real diary by Anonymous. And I don't think I knew anything about it. I picked it up and I checked it out and I read it twice back to back. I read it, and then I went back to the beginning and I read it all the way through again. And, you know, that was 20 years after the book had come out, almost 20 years after the book had come out. And, you know, in many, if not most ways, Alice, you know, the diarist and I had led very different lives, you know, because I was in most ways just a phenomenally boring teenager, in that I wasn't drinking, I wasn't smoking, I wasn't getting high. And so just coming from a totally different sort of walk of life in many ways, and years after the fact, I still found something in that book that spoke to me. It still resonated with me in the way that I think it continues to. And whether Alice herself was real, the feelings that diarist expressed, the things that she felt and the way that she responded to them and the way that she tried to push through every day, and the questions she had about herself and about life and about, is this going to be the way things always are? Are things ever going to get better? Why don't people understand me? Am I going crazy? This is the best day of my life. This is the worst day of my life. Sometimes on the same day, all of those things spoke to me. And so whether the girl or not was real, the connection that she formed and still forms with readers today is absolutely real.
Rick Emerson, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. This was really great.
Rick Emerson, his book is Unmask Alice, LSD, Satanic Panic, and the Imposter Behind the World's Most Notorious Diaries. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd like to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.